Chapter 7. Glenister 2 and a Meeting Under the Flying Arch. There is always strength in numbers. The more individuals or organizations that you can rally to your cause, the better. So said Mark Shields. After the Constitutional Court's adverse judgment in what is widely referred to as Glenister 1 in October 2008, the government proceeded more cautiously with the two bills needed to shut down the Scorpions and redeploy its investigators into a new unit in the police. Although the Polokwane resolution stated that the Scorpions should be urgently dissolved, the government still had to adhere to the law. In line with the Freedom Charter, the spiritual foundation of South Africa's inclusive democracy, adopted at Kliptown in 1955, a degree of participatory democracy embodied in its famous phrase, "the people shall govern," is entrenched in the Constitution, among other things, by providing members of the public with an opportunity to participate in the legislative process. In practice, this means that when new laws are made, interested parties may make written and oral submissions to the relevant parliamentary portfolio committees. In order to facilitate this, details of the legislation as well as public hearings are advertised in the media. While in Glenister 1, the Constitutional Court had found that the specific circumstances did not warrant its intervention in the workings of Parliament and the legislative process, it did acknowledge in principle that it could intervene. Apparently, those in authority interpreted this as a warning that the public participation aspect of making these new laws would need to be in apple pie order. This had the effect of holding up the legislative process into 2009, by which time the ANC had recalled President Thabo Mbeki and Kgalema Motlanthe was acting as caretaker president pending the general election in 2009. Despite strong opposition from the minority parties, Parliament eventually passed the two bills and Motlanthe signed them into law in February 2009, shortly after advising former President F.W. de Klerk and Archbishop Desmond Tutu that if they had any evidence of corruption or other malfeasance in the arms deals, they should report it to the police. These new laws did not sit well with Bob Glenister, but he was reluctant to spend more money on additional litigation. It is rare for a litigant who has lost a major case to go back to court at a later stage. Bob had an arguable case in Glenister 1, and his intentions were pure, but the courts were not prepared to find that the circumstances were exceptional enough to justify its intervention in the legislative process before the laws had reached the statute book. However, both Justice Willem van der Merwe in the High Court and Chief Justice Pius Lange in the Constitutional Court had effectively suggested that the new laws could be scrutinized afresh once they had been placed on the statute book to see whether they passed constitutional muster. On the day the new laws were gazetted, Bob's attorney, Kevin Louis, spoke to me on the phone. During the conversation, I said, "In my view, Bob has paid for his ticket and should be entitled to see the show. We wouldn't expect him to pay us, but the Institute could assist him in finding lawyers who would act for him on contingency. Are you up for it?" Kevin was available to act as the attorney of record in Johannesburg, and Bob was willing to enter into a contingency arrangement with our legal team. I asked Peter Hazel, SC, a retired member of the Cape Bar, to assist, and he readily agreed. Cully Albertain of de Klerk and van Gent, who had acted for the UDM in Glenister 1, was prepared to come on board as the Cape Town attorney of record, also acting on a contingency basis. Bob assembled a full legal team with the minimum of fuss. We fondly imagined that we would be supported by others once the matter got going, with numerous amicus interventions as had been the case in the first round of Bob's legal adventures aimed at saving the scorpions. In the event, this did not come to pass. Once bitten, twice shy seemed to be the order of the day. Other non-governmental organizations with mandates similar to those of Accountability Now were openly skeptical about Bob's chances of success. The opposition political parties were conspicuously absent. In fact, the DA's shadow Minister of Justice, Dean Smuts, scornfully described Accountability Now as one man with a fax machine, using this as part of a justification for staying out of the fray. We never consisted of one person only, and we have certainly never owned a fax machine, a relic of an era long past by the time Accountability Now was formed. Smuts was taken to task by Chris Barron in the Sunday Times and admitted later that the successes of Accountability Now had forced her to eat her own words at many a dinner party. Sadly, she died suddenly in April 2016. Peter Hazel and I sat down and surveyed the pile of paper that had been generated in the course of Glenister One. It was impressively large, created by a talented and skilled team of lawyers in Johannesburg. It was certainly not for lack of trying that the case in the first round had not succeeded. The assembled facts alone would be a huge help in preparing the new challenge. Bob had a choice. Both the North Gauteng High Court in Pretoria and the Western Cape High Court in Cape Town have jurisdiction in reviews of this kind, as the legislature is based in Cape Town and the executive in Pretoria. Given his bad luck when he first took the case to Pretoria, Bob decided to sue in the Western Cape High Court. A direct approach to the Constitutional Court was ruled out. Nothing could be worse than going from Bromfontein to Cape Town and back to Bromfontein, which is what could happen if a direct approach to the Constitutional Court was attempted and rejected. Preparing the founding papers was relatively simple. All we had to do was rehash much of what had been argued before and add some new information. The fresh information largely had to do with the passage of the two bills through Parliament and their final content when they were signed into law. Any law that is inconsistent with the Constitution is invalid. Again, we would ask the court to declare the laws dissolving the scorpions and establishing the hawks as invalid. Peter Hazel and I spent long hours reworking the founding affidavit and examining the constitutionality of the two laws from every conceivable angle. In public interest litigation of this kind, it is best to leave no stone unturned. The court may like a point you think is weak and reject a point you regard as a winning one. The law is as unpredictable as the weather in Port Elizabeth, and just as windy. We decided that the human resources management aspect of the case might benefit from an expert opinion. In our view, a perfectly good system, the Scorpions, located in the National Prosecuting Authority, was being replaced by a deeply flawed one, the Hawks, located in the police. In the process of doing so, members of the Scorpions would receive such a raw deal that the new law would be regarded as an unfair labour practice. Fair labour practices are constitutionally guaranteed. The state is obliged to respect, protect, promote, and fulfil fair labour practices, along with all the other human rights guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. Fortunately, Daan Groeneveld, an experienced practitioner in human resources management field, was a co-founder of Accountability Now. He was able to produce a thoughtful analysis of the reporting lines of the Scorpions compared with those of the Hawks in order to demonstrate the relative independence of the former and the relative lack of independence of the latter. It's all a matter of the contrasting sapiential authority, which is a fancy word for clout, of the two units. According to Don, the lack of gravity apparent in the structure of the Hawks would undermine its independence and accordingly its functional effectiveness. In the process, the ethos of the Scorpions, that had inspired its members and driven them to a high and growing success rate in combating corruption, and high and low places would be destroyed. After much effort, the papers were finalized and served on the usual government respondents. Not unexpectedly, the matter was opposed. Counsel on both sides swiftly approached the Deputy Judge President of the Western Cape High Court with a view to obtaining an early date for hearing. The court agreed, and given the seriousness and urgency of the case, also agreed that it should be heard by a full bench of three judges. A timetable was set up for exchanging further affidavits and for filing heads of argument. Willie Dumini SC, briefed by the state attorney, ably led the team for the state and was very cooperative prior to the hearing. The hearing itself was allocated to judges Siraj Desai, Burton Faree, and Dumisani Zondi. It did not start well. As the three judges filed into court, Dumini slid a pile of paper across the desk towards me, muttering that he'd forgotten to give it to me earlier. It was an application to strike out much of the material we had placed before the court. This device is resorted to when allegedly irrelevant or inadmissible material has been placed on record. I was taken aback by the tardiness of the state team, but told the court that in view of the urgency of the matter and the degree of public interest, we would respond to the striking out application without seeking a postponement. The court accepted this and heard argument from both sides on the merits of the case and on the striking out application, in which the admissibility and relevance of Bob's evidence was under attack over the next few days. Besides attacking the rationality of replacing the hugely effective scorpions with an unknown entity that would be housed in a dysfunctional police service, we assailed the legislative scheme in every conceivable way. The judgment took 9 months to prepare, but was short and to the point. The legislative scheme was deemed to be rational, and the other points raised were beyond the jurisdiction of the High Court. Effectively, the three Cape judges replicated Judge van der Merwe's finding in the North Gauteng High Court 2 years previously. The judgment was handed down by Judge Desai with the concurrence of his colleagues. It summarized our arguments as follows: lack of rationality, absence of accountability, failure of sound human resource management, breach of international obligations, failure to ensure proper public participation in the lawmaking process, infringement of the obligation not to undermine the human rights values enshrined in the Bill of Rights, and failure to allow the National Prosecuting Authority to exercise its functions properly. All of these arguments, except for rationality, were neatly sidestepped by the jurisdiction issue, which Dumini had argued and the court had accepted. The court did not deal with the striking out application at all. However, given the public interest nature of the litigation, it also made no order for costs and expressly rejected a government contention that Bob was being vexatious by pursuing the case after having lost in the Constitutional Court. It was, in fact, time to take the case back to the Constitutional Court. We prepared the necessary papers and encountered the usual opposition. Strangely, the striking out application did not resurface. It was unclear whether this was by design or due to an oversight. We weren't going to ask. The case was difficult enough without a sideshow about possibly striking out much of the material that had so painstakingly been placed on record on Bob's behalf. While the case was pending, I had a chance encounter with Renette Talyot, a recent executive director of the Helen Suzman Foundation, at the IDASA offices in Cape Town. She was a guest speaker at a function I attended, and afterwards we chatted together amiably under a remarkable art installation in IDASA's Dakar room. Entitled The Flying Arch, it depicts Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu swinging from a chandelier in joy at the freedom guaranteed by South Africa's new constitutional order. Idasa had commissioned the sculpture from the artist Ed Young after an open competition. Following the organization's unfortunate closure in 2013, it was first sold to a private buyer and resold on auction in 2015. Renette, previously the youngest member of the first parliament in the new South Africa, had worked hard to help oppose the two bills. On behalf of the Helen Suzman Foundation, she had engaged the legal firm Weber Wenzel to help draft submissions to the Parliamentary Joint Committee aimed at alerting it to the unconstitutionality and folly of the ANC's course of action. Weber Wenzel allocated the brief to a senior partner and former politician, Peter Leon, brother of the then leader of the opposition, Tony Leon. Peter's argument for retaining the scorpions fell on deaf ears, as did all other submissions opposing the legislation. The ANC cadres in Parliament were also not moved by the petition Bob had organized, and the antipathy in the media had no discernible effect on the resolute pursuit of their goal. They stuck to the task of putting the Polokwane resolution into practice and commanded a sufficient majority in Parliament to do so. Renette herself had put a lot of effort into the Helen Suzman Foundation submission to Parliament. She had previously served on SCOPA and still bore the scars of the arms deal cover-up, which she had witnessed and sought to prevent at first hand. A concern about the role of burgeoning corruption in undermining South Africa's constitutional democracy prompted her to take an active interest in the debate about the scorpions. As we chatted, under the benevolent gaze of the swinging arch, she asked how the Glenister case was progressing. "I bewailed our inability to persuade any local organizations to join the fray as friends of the court. Have you asked my successor at the Helen Suzman Foundation, Francis Anthony?" she asked. I replied that I hadn't, despite her contribution to the debate in Parliament. "Well," she retorted, "the Helen Suzman Foundation spent a great deal of money on that debate, and it ought to follow through with at least an amicus intervention now that the case has reached the Constitutional Court for a second time." I took her comment home with me and decided to write an email to Anthony, copied to Peter Leon. The worst that could happen would be a sorry no or no reply at all. I worded the email very carefully, drawing attention to the Helen Suzman Foundation's investment in public participation in the parliamentary proceedings, and encouraging them to follow through on their commitment to the cause. Rather cheekily, I even suggested that if Weber Wenzel would not help on a pro bono basis, I could find lawyers who would be honoured to do so. Lastly, I suggested that the case could best be beefed up in the areas of human rights infringements and international obligations. The email had the desired effect. The Helen Suzman Foundation assembled a highly talented legal team with Weber Wenzel as instructing attorneys, marshaled interns to thoroughly investigate the international ramifications of the case, and generally put its full weight and good reputation behind it. This type of intervention is invaluable to a lone warrior such as Bob. The suggestion, either real or imaginary, express or implied, that a quixotic litigant is tilting at windmills always stalks public interest litigants who take matters to court in their own name. The fervor of the crusader or jihadist tends to alienate the sound and sober pillars of the community. The default position of many people who have grown up under an authoritarian regime is simply to acquiesce in what those in authority do and say. There is not much appetite in the new order for doing the right thing when you've been told to do the wrong thing. Intelligent disobedience is in short supply. Bob is an exception and was fortunate to be assisted by the Helen Suzman Foundation as a result of a chance conversation at a chance meeting under the flying arch in the Dakar room at Idasa. At least Idasa, which no longer exists, can take credit for providing the venue and arranging the occasion on which the chance conversation between Renette and me took place. The Helen Suzman Foundation team took up my suggestion and concentrated their attention on human rights infringements and international law obligations as the strongest weapons in Bob's arsenal. On the international obligations aspect, they assembled all the anti-corruption treaties and conventions to which South Africa is a party and pointed to provisions that would be breached by replacing the scorpions with the hawks. On the human rights infringement aspect, they drew attention to each provision of the Bill of Rights that would or could be implicated in or threatened by the substitution. The Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court, by then Chief Justice Sandile Ngcobo, set down the case for hearing on 2nd September 2010. By that time, the HSF team had been allowed to participate as friends of the court and had filed comprehensive arguments on the two points we had asked them to address. Only 9 judges were available. As we waited for them to file in at the start of the hearing, there was much speculation as to which judges would incline in favour of which party. This normally becomes apparent from the drift of the questions members of the bench directed counsel in the course of the hearing. It was my duty and honour to start the argument. I took the court through the bones of the case, tersely setting out the points that had already been argued in the Western Cape High Court, knowing full well that the judges would ask a lot of questions and that I would not have much time to deal with them. It soon became apparent that some of the judges were interested in the human rights ramifications, while others asked pointed questions about the impact on South Africa's international obligations. David Unterhalter SC, who had represented Bob in Glenister 1 back in 2008, was next up on behalf of the Helen Suzman Foundation. He provided the answers to the questions about the two prominent issues, and his team had placed a great deal of material about the international law aspects of the case before the court. Uli Dumini, SC, who had the task of replying to our arguments, realized from the tenor of the questions streaming into the crucible of argument that the government's case was in trouble. He found some sympathy from the bench, particularly from Acting Justice Fritz Brandt, a former colleague at the Cape Bar, and on secondment from the Supreme Court of Appeal. Questions about the adequacy of the independence of the Hawks were discussed, and the international law aspects of the case became obfuscated. In the last throw of the dice, Dumini decided to try to reintroduce the application to strike out material in Bob's founding affidavit. The Chief Justice would have none of this. He firmly declined to accept the wad of paper offered by Dumini, and nothing further was heard on the topic. By the time the court adjourned at the end of argument, Unterhalter was upbeat. He thought enough of the judges were with us to secure a majority in favour of the proposition that the two laws should be declared invalid. I wasn't sure. Some judges are inscrutable, whether by nature or by design, and the scales were too evenly balanced to be certain of a majority either way. My nervousness was compounded a few weeks later when the court called for additional written argument on the international law aspects of the case. We duly complied and quickly filed answers to the points raised. The wait for judgment began. We warned Bob, who had attended the hearing, that the result could go either way, but that the chances of his being ordered to pay costs were slim. Bob did not believe us, so when the date of judgment, 17th of March 2011, perhaps a nod to my Irish ancestry, it is St. Patrick's Day, was announced, he put on his best suit, tucked his checkbook into the breast pocket, and went to court fully expecting to be asked to pay the government's costs in the matter on the grounds that he had wasted so much of the court's time. To Bob's great surprise, the judges divided 5-4 in his favour on the question of whether the Hawks were fully equipped to fulfil the task previously carried out by the Scorpions. All the judges were agreed that it was legally in order to dispense with the services of the Scorpions. 4 thought the Hawks were an adequate replacement, but 5 did not. A partial win was better than no win at all. When the court order was being read out and its import dawned on him, a look of incredulity, later publicly remarked on by Justice Edwin Cameron, spread over Bob's face. His checkbook remained firmly in his pocket. Parliament was given 18 months to take remedial steps to create an effective and adequately independent substitute for the Scorpions. The business end of the order read, "It is declared that Chapter 6A of the South African Police Service Act No. 68 of 1995 is inconsistent with the Constitution and invalid to the extent that it fails to secure an adequate degree of independence for the Directorate of Priority Crime Investigation." The Declaration of Constitutional Invalidity is suspended for 18 months in order to give Parliament the opportunity to remedy the defect. A media release accompanying the judgment, handed down on 17th March 2011, said the key question in this case was whether the national legislation that created the Hawks and disbanded the Scorpions was constitutionally valid. The majority of the court found that Chapter 6A of the South African Police Services Act 68 of 1995 as amended was inconsistent with the Constitution and invalid to the extent that it failed to secure an adequate degree of independence for the Hawks. The court had made 2 key findings. Firstly, it held that the Constitution imposed an obligation on the state to establish and maintain an independent body to combat corruption and organized crime. While the Constitution did not in express terms command that a corruption fighting unit should be established, its scheme, taken as a whole, imposed a pressing duty on the state to set up a concrete, effective, and independent mechanism to prevent and root out corruption. This obligation was sourced in the Constitution and the international law agreements which were binding on the state. The court points out, the release said, that corruption undermines the rights in the Bill of Rights and imperils our democracy. Section 7(2) of the Constitution imposed a duty on the state to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights. When read with Section 8(1), which provides that the rights in the Bill of Rights bind all branches of government, Section 39(1)(b), which provides that courts must consider international law when interpreting the Bill of Rights, and Section 231, which provides for an international agreement that Parliament approves, binds the Republic. This provision placed an obligation on the state to create an independent corruption-fighting unit. Parliament had approved a number of international agreements on combating corruption, which were binding on the Republic. These required that states create independent anti-corruption entities. Section 7(2) of the Constitution implied that the steps the state should take to protect and fulfill constitutional rights must be reasonable. To create an anti-corruption unit that was not adequately independent, thereby ignoring the binding international law, was not a reasonable constitutional measure. Second, the court found that the Hawks did not meet the constitutional requirement of adequate independence. Consequently, the impugned legislation did not pass constitutional muster. The main reason for this conclusion was that the Hawks were insufficiently insulated from political influence in their structure and functioning. This was because their activities would be coordinated by cabinet, as the statute provided that a ministerial committee could determine policy guidelines in respect of the functioning of the Hawks, as well as for the selection of national priority offences. This form of oversight made the unit vulnerable to political interference. Further, the court held that measures aimed at protecting the Hawks against political influence and interference were inadequate. In addition, the conditions of service of the unit's members, and in particular those applying to its head, made it insufficiently independent. Members had inadequate employment security to carry out their duties vigorously, and appointment of members was not sufficiently shielded from political influence, and remuneration levels were flexible and not secured. These aspects made the unit vulnerable to an undue measure of political influence. Hence, the court upholds the appeal, declares the offending legislative provisions establishing the Hawks constitutionally invalid to the extent that they do not secure adequate independence, and suspends the declaration of constitutional invalidity for a period of 18 months to give Parliament the opportunity to remedy the defect. The minority judgment by Chief Justice Nkobo, in which Acting Judge Brandt, Judge Mogoeng, and Judge Yacoub concurred, held that Section 7(2) of the Constitution, while giving rise to a positive obligation on the state to fight corruption and organised crime, did not specifically impose an obligation on the state to establish an independent corruption-fighting unit. It further held that insofar as such a constitutional obligation was found, the structural and operational autonomy of the Hawks was secured through institutional and legal mechanisms that were adequately designed to prevent undue interference and safeguard the independence of the Hawks. The minority judgment, therefore, concluded that the appeal should be dismissed. Both the majority and the minority judgments concluded that the legislation that created the Hawks could not be invalidated on the grounds that it was irrational or that Parliament had failed to facilitate public involvement in the legislative process. Both judgments further concluded that the Constitution did not oblige Parliament to locate a specialised corruption-fighting unit within the National Prosecuting Authority and nowhere else. Another battle against corruption had been fought, and this time partially won, but the war would continue. Bob's checkbook, snugly in his pocket on the day of the judgment, would be used in further efforts to secure effective and independent state machinery to combat corruption and prevent its further spread.